two drivers rear-end a car on the same afternoon, both delivering groceries for Greenleaf. The first wears a Greenleaf uniform, drives a Greenleaf van, and follows a route the dispatcher set that morning. The second uses their own car, picks their own hours, takes jobs from three other grocers, and is paid a flat fee per delivery. Same crash, same company. Is Greenleaf liable for both? No, only the first. Greenleaf controls the manner and means of the route driver's work, so that driver is an employee. The overflow driver runs an independent business and is controlled only as to the result, so that driver is a contractor. Two steps decide almost every question in this topic, and that was step one. Today, who pays when somebody else does the harm? Here is the route. The two-step engine first. Employee or contractor, then in scope or out. Then the wrinkles the exam lives on, frolic and detour, the commute, intentional torts, the borrowed servant. Then the theories that rescue a plaintiff when respondeat superior fails. And finally, liability that runs sideways, between partners in a shared venture. Start with what the doctrine is for. The person who actually causes an injury is often the one least able to pay. A delivery driver runs a red light and hurts a pedestrian, and the driver may be judgment-proof. No assets, no insurance. But the company that put the driver on the road and profits from the deliveries usually can pay. Vicarious liability means liability imposed on one person for the wrongful act of another, with no need to show the first person did anything wrong. Liability attaches purely because of the relationship. A business that takes the benefit of an activity should bear the losses that activity predictably causes, as a cost of doing business. Almost every employer question reduces to two asked in order. 1. Is the wrongdoer an employee or an independent contractor? Vicarious liability normally reaches only employees. 2. If an employee, was the tort within the scope of employment? The doctrine that answers yes to both is respondeat superior, Latin for let the superior answer. Keep those steps separate because a defendant can lose on either one. An in-scope tort by an independent contractor usually does not reach the hiring party. An out-of-scope tort by an employee usually does not reach the employer. Step 1. And everything turns on control. A worker is an employee when the person who hired them controls, or has the right to control, the manner and means of the work. Not just what result to reach, but how to reach it. A worker is an independent contractor when the hiring party bargains only for a result and leaves the details to the worker's own judgment. Think of a staff accountant against an outside firm. You tell the staff accountant when to arrive, which software to use, and how to do the books. That is control over manner and means. So the accountant is your employee. You hand the outside firm a box of receipts and ask for a finished return by April. You care about the result, so the firm is a contractor. Two cautions. What matters is the right to control, not whether control was actually used. And the label the parties chose is only one factor. Courts look at the real relationship, not the paperwork. Under the Restatement of Agency, Section 7.073 defines an employee as an agent whose principal controls, or may control, the manner and means of the work. The factors that sort them. Degree of control over the details, the single most important one. Whether the worker runs a distinct business of their own. Whether the work is usually supervised or done by an unsupervised specialist. The skill required, where high skill leans contractor. Who supplies the tools and the workplace. The length of the relationship. And how the worker is paid. Run those against Greenleaf. The route driver wears the uniform, drives the company van, follows the dispatcher's route and is paid by the hour. Employee. The overflow driver supplies their own car, sets their own hours, works for several grocers at once, and is paid by the job. Contractor. Same crash, different answer, and control decided it. So the general rule is clean. A hiring party is not vicariously liable for the torts of an independent contractor. The contractor runs their own business and answers for their own mistakes. But the exam loves the exceptions, because that is where the deep pocket comes back. Four of them. 1. Inherently dangerous activities. Work carrying a peculiar risk of harm unless special precautions are taken. Blasting, demolition, crop dusting. The danger cannot be shifted away by hiring it out. 2. Non-delegable duties. Duties the law refuses to let you escape by delegation. Like a landowner's duty to keep premises reasonably safe for invitees. 3. Apparent agency. The hiring party holds the contractor out as its own employee, and the injured person reasonably relies on that appearance. The classic case is a hospital presenting an on-site physician as its own. 4. Negligent selection or supervision of the contractor. Note that fourth one is the hiring party's own negligence, not true vicarious liability. Two traps live here. Do not stop at the label. A fact pattern that calls someone an independent contractor is often testing whether the hiring party actually kept the right to control the details. And when you correctly find a contractor, do not reflexively clear the hiring party. Run those four exceptions first. Step 2. Once the wrongdoer is an employee, the fight moves to scope. The traditional test asks three things. Was the conduct the kind of work the employee was hired to perform? Did it happen substantially within the authorized time and place? And was it motivated, at least in part, by a purpose to serve the employer? The modern restatement folds those into one idea. Conduct is in scope unless the employee went off on an independent course of conduct meant to serve only their own purposes. Either way, the takeaway is the same. Work-related mistakes, even careless or expressly forbidden ones, are usually in scope. Purely personal errands and vendettas are usually out. Add foreseeability to those factors. Minor, foreseeable deviations, and even disobedience of instructions stay in scope. A company rule against speeding does not put a speeding driver outside it. Now, the most heavily tested wrinkle, the frolic and detour line, which appears whenever an employee strays from the assigned task. A detour is a minor, foreseeable deviation, a short personal stop between job sites. The employee is still substantially about the employer's business, so it stays in scope. A frolic is a substantial departure for the employee's own purposes, and that is outside scope. Watch it move. Dev drives a service van for Aquafix in Colombia, traveling between customer homes. Between two jobs, Dev pulls two blocks off the route for coffee and, turning back, hits a cyclist. That short side trip is a detour, so Aquafix is liable. Change the facts. Dev drives 30 miles the other way to help a friend move a couch and hits the cyclist then. Frolic and Aquafix is not liable. And here is the twist that decides close questions. Once an employee abandons a frolic and heads back toward the employer's business, they re-enter the scope and liability resumes. So, if Dev finishes with the couch and is driving toward the next Aquafix job when the crash occurs, Aquafix is liable again. The line is one of degree. Next subrule, coming and going. An employee's ordinary commute to and from work is generally outside the scope, so the employer is not liable for a crash on the way to the office. The commute is the employee's own business. But four well-worn exceptions pull it back in. A special errand for the employer during the trip, which is the dual-purpose doctrine. Employer-paid travel, where the employer pays for the travel time or provides the vehicle. No fixed workplace, where the employee travels among job sites rather than to one location. And a special hazard, where the route exposes the employee to a risk tied to the employment. Intentional torts are the other classic battleground. Because an intentional wrong usually serves the employee's own feelings, the default is that it is outside scope. An employee who assaults a customer over a personal insult acts on a private grudge. But intentional torts fall inside scope in three recurring situations. 1. Force is part of the job. A nightclub bouncer, a security guard, a repossession agent. Force used on the job is what they were hired for. 2. The tort grows out of the work, where violence erupts from a dispute the employment generated. An argument over a bill or job performance, not an unrelated quarrel. 3. An intent to serve the employer, however misguided. The overzealous bill collector. One more wrinkle. The borrowed servant. One employer lends an employee to another, a staffing agency placing a worker at a client. The employer with the right to control the details at the time of the tort bears the liability. Sometimes control is shared closely enough that both are liable. Who had the right to direct the manner and means? Now, keep two very different theories apart, because the exam deliberately blurs them, and mixing them up is the single most common way students lose these questions. Vicarious liability is no-fault liability imposed on the employer solely because of the relationship plus an in-scope tort. The plaintiff need not prove the employer did anything wrong at all. Direct liability is the employer's own negligence in how it handled the employee. Negligent hiring, placing a person in a position when a reasonable background check would have shown them unfit. Negligent supervision or retention, failing to discipline or fire an employee it knew was dangerous. And negligent entrustment, handing a dangerous instrument to someone likely to misuse it. The distinction has real bite. Because direct liability rests on the employer's own fault, it reaches what respondeat superior cannot. Torts by independent contractors and torts outside the scope. So, if a fact pattern shows an employee on a personal frolic, or a nominal contractor obviously dangerous when hired, direct negligence is your route to the employer. There is a third route. A principal is vicariously liable when an agent commits a tort, typically fraud or misrepresentation, while acting with apparent authority, and that apparent authority is what enables the wrong. Apparent authority exists when the principal's own manifestations lead a third party reasonably to believe the agent is authorized. That theory can catch a principal where respondeat superior would not, because it does not depend on the agent being an employee or on scope. It depends on the appearance the principal created. Under Section 7.08, the close link between the apparent authority and the tort is what supports liability. A company clothes an agent with authority to deal with customers. The agent uses it to defraud one, and the company answers. Last, liability that runs sideways between people in a shared undertaking as rough equals. In business law, a joint venture is essentially a partnership formed for a single project. Because it is treated like a partnership, each co-venturer is an agent of the others, so one venturer's in-scope tort can be imputed to the rest. The Revised Uniform Partnership Act supplies the mechanics. Under Sections 305 and 306, a partnership is liable for loss caused by the wrongful act of a partner acting in the ordinary course of the business. And all partners are liable jointly and severally for the partnership's obligations. In tort law, the parallel concept is the joint enterprise, a broader tool for imputing one participant's negligence to another, often in car cases. Four elements: an agreement, express or implied, a common purpose, a community of pecuniary interest, meaning a money-making character rather than a social one, and an equal right of control. That third element is the one the exam tests hardest, because it separates a joint enterprise from ordinary companionship. Friends sharing a ride to a concert or splitting gas have a common purpose and share expenses, but no financial stake in a shared undertaking and no equal right to control the driving. Not a joint enterprise. Add a money-making purpose and shared control, and the elements line up. Anna and Beau, independent jewelry sellers in Olympia, drive together to a trade show, share a booth, split the table fee, and divide what they sell. They take turns driving and jointly decide the route. Beau causes a crash. All four elements. So Beau's negligence is imputed to Anna. Two consequences to close on. Vicarious liability is derivative. It exists only if the actual wrongdoer committed a tort, so if the employee is not liable, there is nothing to impute. And the wrongdoer remains personally liable. Vicarious liability adds a defendant. It does not replace one. They are jointly and severally liable. A word on authorities, because this episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. Vicarious liability lives in the Restatement of Agency and the Partnership Act, and the exam tests whether you can run the two-step engine, not whether you can cite a section. This is a starred topic, so nothing will be handed to you on the page. If you keep only three, keep these. The right to control the manner and means decides employee status. The three scope factors decide respondeat superior. And when respondeat superior fails, direct negligence and apparent authority are still open. Now the traps, and there are five. 1. Accepting the independent contractor label without testing the right to control, and then forgetting the exceptions that revive liability. Inherently dangerous work, a non-delegable duty, apparent agency, and the hiring party's own negligent selection. 2. Confusing no-fault vicarious liability with the employer's own negligence. 3. Treating every deviation as a frolic. Most minor foreseeable side trips are detours and stay in scope, and an employee heading back toward the job re-enters it. 4. Assuming the employer is liable for the commute, which it usually is not, or never liable for intentional torts, which is sometimes wrong. 5. Calling any shared car trip a joint enterprise without the pecuniary interest and equal control elements. And one piece of exam craft. This same respondeat superior principle appears on the torts side of the exam, under liability for the acts of others. A business association's rule can surface inside a torts fact pattern. Time for the quick check, straight from the Bargo question bank. A trucking company hired a driver a year ago without checking his record, which would have shown several recent convictions for driving under the influence. Late one night, long after clocking out, the driver takes a company truck without permission. He drives off on a purely personal trip, drinks heavily, and causes a crash that badly injures a family. Respondeat superior plainly fails. The driver was off duty, on a personal frolic, in a vehicle he was not authorized to use. The family's lawyer looks for another route to the company's deeper pocket. Which theory best supports holding it liable despite the frolic? Option 1. Negligent hiring, because a reasonable background check would have revealed the driver's record. Option 2. Respondeat superior, because the driver was using the company's own truck. Option 3. apparent authority because the company let the driver appear authorized to use the truck. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 1. When respondeat superior fails, the plaintiff can still reach the employer through its own direct negligence. A reasonable background check would have revealed the record. Putting that driver behind a company truck was the company's own fault, and direct liability reaches conduct outside the scope of employment. Option 2 tries to revive respondeat superior, but using the company truck does not put a personal, off-duty frolic back in scope. Option 3 misapplies apparent authority. Nothing shows the company held the driver out as authorized to take the truck, and no third party relied on any such appearance. 5 things to take away. 1. 2 steps decide almost everything, employee or contractor, then in scope or out. 2. Employee status turns on the right to control the manner and means, not the label on the contract, and not whether control was actually used. 3. Most deviations are detours and stay in scope. A frolic is a substantial personal departure, and an employee heading back to the job re-enters scope. 4. Vicarious liability needs no employer fault at all, while direct negligence needs fault, but reaches contractors and out-of-scope torts. 5. A joint enterprise needs a financial stake and equal control, not just a shared purpose and split gas, which is why Greenleaf answers for one of those 2 crashes and not the other. Control decided it. Next time, partnerships. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.